I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
Georgia starts 2019 with a new governor, a new legislature, some new members of Congress, a new transit agency for the Atlanta area, but coming to town for Atlanta's Super Bowl, the same old Patriots, you remember them. Suddenly, that other team with its new old home in L.A. has a whole lot of new fans in the ATL. Meanwhile, Democrats and Republicans continue their old no-gain scrimmage in D.C., but at least the Saints are staying in New Orleans, even though their billboards aren't, and we can enjoy a new political breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Who dat joining us? Our regulars, of course. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor, now former Governor, Nathan Deal. Welcome back, guys.
Good to be back. Good morning.
Let's start, of course, with the new governor. Brian, I'm going to start with you as someone who has worked with a new governor in his first State of the State message, his first budget proposal, and so forth. After that, do we have any further clue as to what Brian Kemp's overall strategy is?
In the State of the State address, we did get some good substance, some good meat thrown out there. We know he's going to have some focus on education. He went right at the teacher pay raises that he promised, and now he's
not as big as initially promised, but 3,000 instead of 5.
With the 2,000 to come later, mm-hmm. over the period of these 4 years that he's serving in his first term as governor. He's got a focus on school safety, which, of course, is very important for Republicans because it's got some bipartisan appeal. That's something that all parents care about, regardless of whether or not they like Brian Kemp or not. It's hugely important for Republicans to get something done so that we have more security and also a feeling of security as parents with our kids in these schools that what we hear all these awful things happening across the country. Luckily, hasn't happened here. We're also hearing him talk a little bit about a Medicaid waiver. He mentioned the State of the State, putting some money aside for a study to put a waiver together. This, of course, is a way for the state of Georgia to get some of our Medicaid expansion dollars. So I am proud of him for showing some vision here, for taking a stand and moving us in the right direction. And as I said in the last podcast, I think Tom Price, our former congressman who was Health and Human Services Secretary, should be at the forefront of figuring this out.
Now, that's interesting because there's $1 million in that budget proposal for some outside help to fashion a Medicaid waiver.
Yeah.
Is some of that going to Tom Price?
I haven't heard that. I think there's a lot of speculation on that. I hope so. I mean, as I said, 2 weeks ago, before any of this came up, I said that's what we should do. So I hope that's what we do. But look, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. 3 years ago, the Georgia Healthcare Access Task Force, which in full disclosure I did work for, worked with a consulting firm with healthcare expertise mm-hmm. to create a Georgia-based waiver plan. So the blueprint that already exists.
Yeah. So why do we need another outside consultant at a cost of $1 million?
Obviously, it's not just a situation where one can flip over to the other. It is 2 years old now. There may need to be some updates. There may need to be a way that it needs to be tailored so that the Trump administration will approve it. There do need to be some smart minds who are well-connected and know this policy inside and out, back at the table. All that I encourage there is that blueprint that's already there be used as a starting point.
A few things to really note here, Dennis, is that Governor Kemp's budget is $1.5 billion more than Governor Deal's last budget.
So $27.5 billion.
And so for our listeners, that just shows you the magnitude that, yes, Governor Deal and his administration deserves a lot of credit for building up the rainy day fund. But if you really look at this sort of robust, very bold budget that Governor Kemp has put forward, it's going to really take a lot of money to really fund all the things that he wants to fund. I agree with you, Dennis, is that we got to figure out where is this $1 million going to basically do some study to figure out whether we need waivers or not. I would say this. I think if anybody deserves some of that money besides Tom Price, I think Brian Robinson should get a little bit of that money. Only problem is that his fees are probably so expensive that they'll kind of blow through that $1 million.
I'm going to come in at right at $999,000. I know it's within budget. I know that that they can afford it.
But in all seriousness, I just wanted to really sort of state the magnitude of this bold vision that this governor has. And it reflects in his budget proposals. I agree with Brian. I think we got to do something about child safety in our schools. Also, he's put a mental health counselor. Mm-hmm. I will want to put him
$8.4 million for that.
Yeah, and so as someone who really believes that counselors can really continue to be that extension of the family support that these children need, and also, you know, listen, he wants to put $150 million, I think, towards looking at some new voting machines. We know that there was some voter irregularities and problems from this last election. I have said publicly, I don't think $150 million is enough. It's a great start, and this governor deserves a lot of credit for starting that. But we need some federal assistance. Maybe some cities and counties particularly can request grants to the federal level to try to get more funding on a local level to make sure that we don't have some of these voting problems in the future.
I want to come back to the voting machines in a minute, but let's pick up for a moment on education. Brian, you know as well as anyone that once a budget goes to the legislature, they find their own things they want to spend money on. And on the subject of education, there's been a lot of talk about expanding vouchers or private school scholarships or whatever you want to call them, expand the pool of money that goes to those things.
Yeah.
Is that going to happen? And with the governor looking at a base that wants those sort of things, is he going to be able to do that?
What the Republican General Assembly and in the past with Governor Deal has done is move incrementally on that over time. It's never a revolutionary change that takes a huge chunk of the budget at one time. It's been done really over the past decade, little by little, and I think we're going to continue with that incrementalism. But let's take a step back here and look at the strategy. Republicans are looking for issues that unite their caucuses, which are now smaller than they were in recent sessions. They also know that the gun sites on them in some of these metro Atlanta districts, that the majorities are in danger. So you're going to see them calculate a little bit more on those issues. And while they still do have to speak to that constituency that wants more choice, and not just choice for rich white kids, which is what the Democrats are going to say, it's also for kids who are living in poverty, kids whose local school district is terrible, has bad test scores, maybe is even dangerous. So it's about school choice for everybody in Georgia to get what's best for their child. Not all schools are alike. They offer different things for different kids. So school choice is important. It's something that black people, white people, Latinos, Asian Americans should all come together on and push forward in a sensible, slow way. But let me say this. Republicans aren't looking for issues right out the gate that are going to divide their caucus. Right? They're going to look for issues that unify them. And school choice and public versus charter, public versus private, those drive a wedge within the caucus because many Republicans represent districts where 95%+ of the kids go to public school. So they don't quite have as much interest in some of these choice issues and private school help and charter school, et cetera.
And they're politically divisive across party lines, too. I mean, you're not going to get a lot of Democratic support for them.
They don't believe in school choice. They believe in authoritarianism. Kind of joking.
Listen, there's not a huge appetite from Democrats to really enter into this conversation around school choice. And Brian is absolutely right. Democrats in this state have been very, very vocal about making sure that we fully fund public education in the state. That was one of the things that Stacey Abrams ran on. Remember, she sort of coined herself as the public education governor if she were to be elected, and that didn't happen. But
Governor Kemp has promised to continue fully funding the existing public education formula.
Which is another big commitment from this governor. And I'll be honest with you. Listen, Brian has been hearing some of the rumblings that I've been hearing. I mean, if you look at some of the recent polling numbers, I think that the Republican base and caucus thinks that this is a new sort of Governor Kemp that they didn't see in the primary, and they saw a glimpse of it in the general. But I would love to see how this develops, because a lot of these issues that he sort of come out on are issues that he really didn't take a hard stance against during the election, but he did sort of leave enough room for him to pivot once governor to really put some of this in funding. Now, Democrats have got to be careful, because if you look at this budget, there's still some holes there. I mean, there's still some things that you can push for. I was with Minority Leader Bob Trammell the other day, who believes that the certificate of need issue and the Medicaid expansion issue should be looped together because they can mutually inclusively help each other.
Now, that's very true. Very quickly, the certificate of need debate is over a state requirement that exists now that says if you want to build a new hospital someplace, you have to prove that there is a need for that hospital and you're not duplicating things that other hospitals are already providing.
It's not even just hospitals. It's also like these
medical services,
yeah. Like, you know, in and out surgery centers and stuff that would compete with county-owned hospitals or other hospitals.
And it's been a huge subject of debate for many years in the legislature.
And what can't go unsaid is that the reason why we have these is because hospitals have to take non-paying customers, whoever comes mm-hmm. through the door. And so it's not a free market. If one operator has to take whoever comes through the door, and many of them can't pay, they can't compete against operators who can only pick paying customers. So that is the rub. It's not just a matter of the government, mm-hmm. you know, interfering with the free market. There is no free market in healthcare.
And the problem, I think, is not just when we're speaking of hospitals, to come back to what Theron was saying about certificate of need and Medicaid expansion linked, is that we have rural hospitals that are struggling right now. And if we go and analyze how a Medicaid waiver might take shape and take a lot of time to do that, do those rural hospitals have that kind of time? We're already losing them.
Well, they don't. And one of the things, again, that I think that Governor Kemp heard loud and clear when he was touring around the state, particularly on his rural tour, I'm sure, and we've talked about it a lot on this podcast, and Brian does a really good job of articulating how if we right now, God forbid, have something happen to us, I mean, we literally have four or five hospitals within this, you know, 10-mile radius to get some care. But in some of these rural counties, and I don't want to steal this away from Brian, but he does a better job articulating this, but it could take these folks upwards to 30 minutes to an hour and a half to get to their nearest hospital if they have some type of fatal accident or something, you know, tragic happens to them. And so I think that the rural hospital debate is something I think that you can see Democrats and Republicans come together to work on.
Let's come back to the voting machines for a moment, because we touched on that briefly. Brian, is the governor, do you think, committed to the idea, which is fiercely debated, of a totally computerized system at the front end? In other words, the voter goes on a machine and touches the machine, but there's a paper record at the back end? Or is he still open to the idea of having a hand-marked ballot that's then counted by a computer?
Gosh, I hope we don't go to the hand-marked ballot. You know, Theron and I actually did a panel this week, and the speaker before us was the Fulton County election supervisor. And it was really enlightening. I'm glad I got there early enough to hear it.
Rick Barron.
Yeah, I learned a lot from what he was saying. And he said paper ballots would be a nightmare, and they're not foolproof. The idea that this is going to solve all our problems. I mean, look at what happened in Florida in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. Those are paper ballots. They were punch paper
they were
ballots.
Punched. Yeah.
But there were still problems. So there's not a foolproof method. The best, because what we, he made the point that what we have now is outdated as they are. He said, one, they're not hackable. People should quit saying they are. And two, voters only get one choice, and the computer keeps you from, like, overvoting and then spoiling your ballot, you know. So there's
some
safeguards in our current
system. Yeah, I recall back when we had some counties that had the, I think it was called OptiScan,
yeah,
where you filled in the little bubble. But if you went outside of the bubble, if you filled in a little too much, you know, the machine wouldn't read it properly. There were problems with those too. It seems like we can't come up with a foolproof system, but a lot of people are concerned about the idea that they can't mark their own ballot. And Theron, is that going to continue to be an issue?
AJC recently published a poll that said that the majority of Georgians think that we should have a handwritten paper ballot. And so this is something that Democrats around the SAFE Commission, when it was discussed about what do we do going forward with our voting machines, even though they, I think, recommended that we go into this sort of digital slash hand paper ballot option to basically have a receipt that confirms your vote electronically, you saw the Democrats come out pretty forcefully in a united front and say, no, we want handwritten paper ballots. And so I think that this is something that the governor and Secretary of State Raffensperger is going to have to compromise on. I think if you do not have some type of paper component, if you do not have some type of component that gives the Georgia voters some type of security and sense of calm that their vote has been counted accurately, then you're going to see a really big uproar from the Georgians on this.
We got time, Brian, though, because the 2020 election is coming up on us, and it's going to take a while to implement whatever the legislature passes.
It is, and I don't know if that would be ready by 2020, particularly considering that a decision has not been reached as of today, and we're still some time away from it. I think Darren's right, and I think what we need is a computerized system that has a paper record at the end of it, like a print off or however you would do it. And, you know, we know who those vendors are who are offering that product. We need to narrow it down, find the best one that's cost conscious for us, and get them going as soon as possible. One thing that I do want to follow up on what Darren said is he made this point the other night. There were problems in some counties. And interestingly, it's all within this context of Democrats saying there was voter suppression because the lines were too long and machines didn't work. All of the counties where you hear that are run by Democrats. So I just want to make that point.
What? Not all of them.
Yeah, pretty much all of them.
No, and the thing is, you know, I was with the mayor of Augusta, Georgia, and he was telling me in some of the surrounding counties in Jefferson County, you know, we remember that county, that's where the local elected officials there wouldn't let the seniors get on the bus to go vote. But there were some areas along the coastal part of Georgia that are not run by Democrats that had some problems. We just didn't hear them here in Atlanta metropolitan area because they were in other parts of the state. And so I think that, look, that we know we have dated machines, so we got to get new machines, check. But we've got to give Georgians the sense of security and calm to know that their votes are being counted accurately.
One wrinkle on that, Brian, is that there's been a revival by state Democrats of an investigation done by, I believe it was McClatchy originally, one of the media organizations that found that David Dove, who was Kemp's chief of staff when he was Secretary of State, was at what Democrats call a junket that was put on by one of the major voting machine companies. And Charles Harper, his new deputy chief of staff, has been a chief lobbyist for that company. So are we running into a perception problem at the very least here?
So I've talked to Chuck Harper, and that was something that came up here locally recently. And I just flat out asked him, I said, listen, you know, what measures did you take to ensure that once you became a part of the governor's transition team and now his deputy chief of staff, to make sure that you had no coordination and no activities with this company who he did lobby for. And what he said to me, Dennis, is that he said, not only did I proactively sort of remove myself from day to day and I didn't register as a lobbyist for this company, but we put up blocks and make sure that there's no coordination, no communications with me and in my role as deputy chief of staff regarding the voting machines. However, Chuck's a good man, but to your point that you just laid out, it just kind of, again, in this sort of nation where we know that there's a lot of things that go on in campaigns. I'm a registered state lobbyist, so I'm not trying to discourage anyone from lobbying legally and if they're registered for a company. But to go into administration and have had those relationships, it does give the Democrats an opportunity to raise some questions. But that's why I, you know, had a direct conversation with Chuck. And I think that he's, you know, taking the necessary actions to make sure that he's totally removed from that company and that process.
Do we need longer periods of time, though, between when one works for one side of the revolving door and when one goes through the revolving door and works for the other side?
We already have that for elected officials. Mm-hmm. And
should we have it for lobbyists, especially at appointed positions?
No.
Let's say this practically. You know, look, I believe in transparency. I believe that legislators and the public have the right to know that there are high-ranking officials in the Kemp administration who have those previous relationships. I think that's hugely important. And I think it's something that Republican legislators will keep in mind as they go through the process. So that's all fully disclosed. We all know who's aligned where and what the past relationships are. But let's look at it practically as far as the revolving door. So Chuck Harper was a lobbyist. He's going to come into the governor's office as a staffer. these people can't necessarily take a year off of work. And what else are they going to do for that year? Go work at McDonald's or, you know, rake yards in the neighborhood? I mean, this is what they do professionally, and we've got to think about it practically in that sense. And transparency and disclosure is a part of how we can handle it in an ethical manner. Is there some optics problems with the public? Absolutely. And I think that we need to address those by being as clear with them on our affiliations as possible.
Yeah, but I think the thing also to make this bigger than Chuck Harper and David Dove, who are all good guys who I think heart is in the right place and want to do the best they can for this governor, is that Brian knows this. Like, it's just not a lot of talent out here. And so, you know, I'm a lobbyist, Brian is not. But even if Brian is a communications, you know, public consultant, and he decides to go in and work for anybody, you know, he shouldn't be sort of criticized for some of his affiliations while he was trying to make a living for his family. And same as a lobbyist, where we go out and we represent companies that want to do business with the state, want to do business with local governments. And a lot of times these elected officials, especially if they decide to aspire for higher offices, if they have that worked-in relationship, working together on issues with lobbyists, a lot of times they want those folks to come in-house, because when someone like me comes knocking at the door, you kind of can help your governor or your congressman or your mayor sort of get them an opportunity to know how this debate is going to be framed, and whether it's promoting an issue or defending an issue or trying to promote a bill. Whatever. So I don't think we need to start restricting lobbyists. But as Brian indicated, there is a law in place around elected officials, particularly on the state.
Meanwhile, Governor Kemp revised the rules. This is something he did on his very first day in office. He revised the rules on sexual harassment complaints in agencies over which the governor's office has control. There's trying to streamline the process. There's a single place to file the same standards across the board for each agency, some designated people in each agency to investigate. But how quickly can this happen? Is there the money there to do this? Because sexual harassment at the Capitol has been an issue for years.
I don't know that money is the issue so much as it is changing the culture and creating a process and modernizing state government as an employer to come up to the standards of corporate America and what they've been doing. And this obviously in the last couple of years has exploded onto the scene as a big topic of conversation. Now, it's always been on the scene, right? I mean, the Me Too movement isn't a reaction to something that just started. You know, this has been going on for a long time in the workplace, and we're slowly catching up to modern standards. So I applaud him not just for doing this, because again, this is bringing us in line with what is already happening all over the country. What I applaud him for is for on his first day showing particularly the women of Georgia that he listened and that he takes it seriously, and this is a priority. To come out straight out the gate and do this sends a message about how much the rights of women and their voices mean to him and will mean to his administration. I applaud him.
Theron, well, at the same time, the state Senate limited the time to file sexual harassment complaints in the areas covered by the state Senate to 2 years. And the theory was, okay, there's been some study on this and that was a recommendation, but does that clash with the message that Governor Kemp is trying to send when it comes to the agencies that the governor controls?
That's a good point, Dennis. And it's now a debate of what do we take what the governor has put in place and or do we go with what the Senate has put in place? Because what it really is boiling down to is that if something happens to anybody, particularly a woman, that they should not be intimidated. They should not be forced to come forward at a time where they're not ready. But you do have these instances where people wait years and years and years and years and years. And I want to be clear. I'm not saying that if sexual assault or sexual harassment happens, that one shouldn't feel that they need to be rushed. I mean, they should come and talk about it and disclose it at any moment. But the bottom line is that, as Brian talked about, we all hear stories. We know that there's a culture at the Capitol that I believe has definitely improved.
Absolutely.
Over the years.
It's way better. It's not the frat house it once was.
Yeah, it's not like it was. And so, but I think that you got to make sure that there's a compromise in a way where if particularly a woman, but it may happen to a man, you know, we don't know if that's ever been reported, that it's fair and that people can come and report it and then it's going to be investigated properly.
You know, I want to respond because there was some criticism and pushback. I heard it from Democrats, but it may have been from other quarters as well, against Senate leadership because they put a time limit on the filing. It was infinity before. There was no deadline. All they did was put a deadline on. And by the way, it's one that is within the standards across the country in corporate America and in other state governments. It is a very fair standard. And we don't want anybody to have to suffer from harassment or from an assault of any sort. But there's a reason why we have statutes of limitation in this country. We know scientifically that memories change. We know that sometimes false accusations can be used as political fodder to destroy somebody who's innocent. So there's got to be some balance in it. And I think that this is one that is a fair way to address the needs of victims and give them their hearing while also protecting, you know, other people from false accusations.
All of this is happening as an Atlanta Journal-Constitution poll just out shows that Governor Kemp is starting, at least according to the poll, with really low voter approval, at least among registered voters, 37.2%. This is a guy who won. So, Theron, do you wonder whether the poll is accurate? Do you think this is going to change how Democrats approach him if they think, okay, he's starting out, you know, having to dig himself out of a hole. We might be able to do some things we didn't think we could do after the election.
I have a theory about these poll numbers, Dennis, and I don't think an incoming governor in any state is going to be at 37%.
Amen, brother.
All right. However, here we go. With Stacey Abrams and her proper wait time to make sure that the votes were counted accurately, and some think was a concession speech, but she said she was not conceding. And then the launch of the Fair Fight Georgia gave her a tremendous amount of opportunity to earn media and place doubt in the election results. However, what Governor Kemp did, and at the time Governor-elect Kemp, I think sort of pushed back on a lot of these narratives because, I mean, he reached out all across the aisle in the metro area. He went around a rural tour.
Went to City Hall.
He went to City Hall. He went to the slain officer funeral in DeKalb County. He even met with Commissioner Rob Pitts, who was the chair of the Fulton County Commission.
And he just settled that lawsuit over the $500,000 in unpaid funds from a loan that he guaranteed. That was an issue that was brought up not only by Democrats but by Republicans in the primary.
But what the poll also said is that Stacey Abrams had, I think, a 50-plus percent favorability in the state. And so I do believe that number is accurate. And I think that what she's having to decide is, okay, do I really believe this poll in its totality, or do you know whether or not she runs in 2020-22? But I definitely think that this gives the Kemp administration a little bit of pause because they've got it now, and I'm just going to warn Democrats, get ready. I don't know him as well as some people, but I do know this governor. I think that his people around him are looking at those polling numbers, and people like Brian and others, while we don't believe it's exactly that low, that you're going to start seeing him at a time when he's released this budget that's been very robust, very statesmanlike, to figure out one or two issues that he can sort of shore up some support in his base. Because I tell you this, it's all about when the poll was conducted and who they talked to. And I know Brian has dissected that, right? However, if he has a second poll that comes up during this session or after the session, and if it's not a tremendous bump, then that is going to be when I'm going to say on this podcast, all right, I believe the numbers. I think they're true. But I think we got to give him a chance. There's no way that he's at 37% at a time where he hasn't really been able to even govern for a whole month.
I'm so glad that we have been doing this podcast and this broadcast for more than 3 years now, because there's a record of the things that I've been saying over those 3 years. And you guys love to point it out when I say stuff that is proven wrong in time. So I want to point out where I'm proven right. And what have I said consistently for the last 2 years? That public polling in Georgia oversamples Democrats. We see this leading up into elections every time. Every time I say it, don't trust these numbers. There's always a Democratic skew. I don't know why, but they oversample Democrats. And the Democratic candidate always performs much better in the late polling than they do on election day. And every time I am proven right. And that's got to be what this is. I am shocked that it's this far off. There is, as Theron said, there's no incoming governor in America with 37% approval rating if nothing bad happened. I mean, you'd have to be indicted, have pictures of you in compromising situations. say something that was horribly offensive to many people in your state. Do something embarrassing. None of those things have happened. He has been a statesman. He had a good inaugural speech. He had a good State of the State of speech. He's been showing up in minority communities, going to the MLK Day ceremony where he was very rudely treated by the other speakers. And he stood there and handled it with dignity
and
grace.
But that all happened after, to be fair, while this poll was not being conducted. I think that's fair to say that what you just laid out, the MLK Day speech, reaching out to the maybe reaching out to the local Democrats, but a lot of things that you just mentioned happened after this poll was.
But nothing bad has happened.
No, it happened.
Nothing bad has happened that would justify him. I think that his numbers are probably this bad in many parts of Metro Atlanta. I think those numbers will be accurate in Gwinnett County. They may be accurate in Cobb County even.
But the poll,
but not statewide.
But the poll actually, I mean, I'm sure you've seen the crosstabs. I mean, and I looked at them. I mean, it was a poll that. I wouldn't say oversample. It kind of highly sampled Metro Atlanta.
That's a good dance there.
But it did have South Georgia. And here's the thing. Get into this poll. Where I was really shocked is that he is not doing as well as he should be doing in North Georgia. And here's where I'm going with this. You know, he's an Athenian. I'm an Athenian. But we've had the Gainesville Mafia in control for the last 8 years.
I'm an honorary member of the Gainesville Mafia.
You know, and so Brian looked at the poll like I did. South Georgia, he's strong. Metro, not doing so well. But where the battleground is North Georgia. I mean, go back and look at the polling numbers. There was, and here's the people who are the Republicans that are against him. These are educated, college educated, master degree or higher, suburban women between the ages of 35 and 60. And that's something that he's got to prove on. Those
I don't agree with everything Theron said, but that last bit, he's dead on. That is the battleground.
Yeah.
Much more of the Political Breakfast still to come. Stay right here. And we are back. Thanks for coming along with us for the Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare, once again, with Democratic strategist Theron Johnson and Republican strategist Brian Robinson. The federal government shutdown continues as we speak, as Atlanta is getting ready for the Super Bowl, as the airport is getting ready for huge crowds coming in for the Super Bowl. Senator Johnny Isaacson went on the floor of the Senate to say we've got to do something. Brian, let me ask you, Senator Isaacson is one of those people who is not only respected across the aisle, but he, in his real life, prior to becoming a congressman and a senator, was a deal maker, Northside Realty. I mean, this is someone who might be able to make that kind of a deal between the Democrats and the Trump administration. But does he have the boost in his own party to do that?
Well, that's been the sort of the issue that we've seen with Leader McConnell. I believe we discussed Leader McConnell's challenge in the last podcast, because I think in his heart of hearts, he knows we need to get this thing restarted, but he can't do it against the will of the majority of his caucus, even if it's the will of the majority of the Senate, right?
But so he could have some challenge. Help from a fellow Georgian, David Perdue, who's close to the Trump administration, if Senator Perdue chose to do that.
We need to get something done. And I don't like to be overtly partisan on this podcast, because that's not what our purpose is. But I will say this. Democrats are now treading into more dangerous territory than the Republicans, because people are hearing Trump out there going, okay, I'm willing to compromise on this. I'm willing to compromise on this. And by the way, the stuff he's given up is stuff that will cause him trouble with his right flank, with the cultures of the world.
But it's stuff that he took away. Too. So the Democrats are arguing, hey, you're not really giving anything. You're just putting back what you took
away. He is giving something. He is giving, because he has the leverage. He is the president of the United States, and he has the ability to do what he has done on DACA and on the people who come from dangerous countries, whatever that refugee status is. So these are big gives for him. I mean, some in the right are already bashing him for being willing to compromise. And the Democrats are saying very clearly, and people are hearing them, we will not compromise. We will let the TSA agents starve to death. We're not going to do anything.
So let me jump in here. So, Dennis, you just pointed out, we know that this president made a lot of promises that he cannot fulfill. One of the promises that he made last year was that he would actually put in funding for DACA. So this whole notion to say, hey, now I'm going to come back and to put DACA into my, you know, rebuttal or sort of my counteroffer is not new news. I also want to say this. Democrats have put forth eight bills that will reopen the government. All right. So since they have been there, and I feel so sorry for these new members of Congress, like Congresswoman Lucy McBath, who wants to get there and roll up her sleeves and get to work for her district. But you can't do anything when the government shut down. So I want to repeat that. Democratic House members, a Democratic-controlled House, has introduced 8 bills. Senator McConnell won't even take them up because you have these Republican senators who are supporting this president, which I think is a losing battle for them. And you want to talk about TSA and U.S. Customs workers. This really hit home for me this week. So my best friend, who's going to be the best man at my wedding, I never called him because I just thought that there was no way that he's a U.S. Customs officer. He's an essential employee, higher-ranking supervisor. There's no way that you would be affected by this shutdown. Had a conversation with him the other day, and he tells me, Dennis, that he has been furloughed for the last 30-plus days and has to come to work and protect us, protect the bad guys that Trump likes to talk about, protect all these drugs and all these weapons coming out of our country. He literally has woke up every single day and went to work for free. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm not going to show up anywhere probably more than 2 days in a consistent manner for free. And so this whole thing about, you know, it's Trump's fault, it's the Democrats' fault. Look, Trump is the president of this United States. He can reopen the government today, and then we can have a conversation about border security. We can have a conversation about a wall. But he is basically using these workers, and he's throwing a temper tantrum to shut down this government. And I want to say this. I think Nancy Pelosi, to shut down the State of the Union, I want to applaud her for that. He has met his match in Speaker Pelosi. I think Speaker Pelosi realizes that she's got this mantle, whether she gets it again or not, or whether she holds on to it for 2 years or 20 years, she's going to stand up to this president, and she's going to make him reopen this government.
It won't be 20 years. That'll make her, like, what, 132?
Coming back for a moment to the two Georgia senators, David Perdue, an ally of the president who can talk to the president, Johnny Isaacson, someone who can talk to Democrats, are they in a unique position to possibly be among those who break the ice here?
Absolutely. One, they have very different profiles. Johnny Isaacson is seen as more of a deal maker, bring people together to get a pragmatic solution, very much like Lindsey Graham kind of has that reputation as well, at least over the long term he has. David Perdue, however, has branded himself as a strong ally of President Trump from the very beginning. Was one of his early supporters during the primary. And when Mitt Romney went after Trump, it was Perdue who was chosen or perhaps stood up to go after Mitt Romney and to defend the president. So there is a unique relationship of trust there. And with Senator Perdue being on the ballot in 2020, he's got a particular opportunity here because the Georgia that he will face in 2020 is different than the one he faced in 2014. It is a more Democratic state. It is trending fast in that direction. The Democrats are putting forward more and more serious candidates for these offices. We've had some non-serious candidates in the past because Democrats didn't think they had a chance.
And Stacey Abrams could be among them, although she's thinking about it.
And she's very serious. And we know she's a proven fundraiser. I think it would be politically opportunistic and pragmatic and brilliant for Perdue to be seen as coming to the rescue here, coming forward with a plan that gets people back to work in the federal government and gets things going again and maybe has some sort of compromise on these immigration issues. Because David Perdue cannot replicate the Kemp winning formula. The numbers won't work again. What Kemp pulled off won't work again. Perdue has got to bring back the Republicans that we lost in the 6th Congressional District, in the 7th Congressional District, in the 11th Congressional District, across the north side of Atlanta, and then across some of the south side of Atlanta as well. He's got to go get those people. For example, in the 6th District, Karen Hendel lost, but she got 17,000 more votes than Kemp did. So that shows you that's that swing Republican, and Perdue's got to go get them. And let me tell you, Perdue can talk to them by being seen as a problem solver and solution driver in this debate.
Perdue has lost all those things that Brian just laid out. You know, the David Perdue that we saw 6 years ago was this outsider. Remember, he was the inventor of the outsider. Trump stole it from him, which he's done. A lot of people, they're stealing their ideas over his history as being a businessman and now president. The David Perdue who we saw in 2014, that's just not going to work. I totally agree with Brian in 2020. Here's the problem with David Perdue trying to move to the middle. You can't move to the middle when you have been not only the chief defender, but you've been the chief promoter. You have basically supported this president on every single initiative that he's put forward. So you want him to now be the person that comes and saves us and to basically reopen the government? No way, Brian. And you want to tell those women up in the 6th District who I talked to are outraged with this president. And so all it's going to take, and you already see it right here in Georgia, they're running ads against Senator Perdue right now, linking him to Trump.
But in terms of a deal to reopen the government, is this where Johnny Isaacson comes
in?
Well,
here's the problem.
And let's, that link with David Perdue.
Yeah, but let's just link to the president. Love Johnny Isaacson. Great American, great Georgia. But here's the bottom line, and Republicans are not going to say it, and I'm going to say it. Johnny Isaacson has been saying this, Dennis, since Donald Trump has been on the ballot for president. All right, he has been trying to be a sensible person to try to make sure that everyone's calm and give him a chance. Johnny Isaacson is not being heard by his fellow Republicans, and they're disrespecting him. To have this Georgia, who quite frankly has developed a reputation for fighting for our veterans and being a person that Democrats will at least be willing to listen to and work with, he has gone to the Senate microphone time and time again and has pleaded with his fellow senators, including David Perdue, to back him in his response. Now, Republicans have been very smart. They don't criticize Johnny Isaacson for doing that because for a lot of reasons that I don't need to get into, right? But the bottom line is this. David Perdue and Johnny Isaacson are never going to come together when it has the issue of dealing with Donald Trump because I think they fundamentally disagree about the mentality, the heart, the morality of this president. And I think that David Perdue is trying to soften himself up a little bit. He was at the MLK Day event over at Ebenezer Church, gay to welcome.
There have been years when he has not been there.
He has been
there.
And then Johnny,
Senator Isaacson is there every year.
Every year. And Senator, I was getting to that, Dennis. Senator Isaacson was actually there in the audience. So, no, David Perdue, and Brian is right, and they need to hire Brian if they haven't already. No, seriously, they need to because what Governor Kemp did in running that very sort of energetic, sort of radical at times. I'm going to be very careful. I don't call him radical, but there were some radical commercials and some things that happened. It's not going to work. And you're trying to soften a man that Democrats are going to spend millions of dollars wrapping Donald Trump and all the things that he said good about this president around his neck. And I think that if Stacey Abrams runs, and let's not forget about there's Teresa Thomason out there who's thinking about running. You also got Sarah Riggs Amico who's thinking about running. You also have John Barrow who's thinking about running. You also have a lot of people encouraging Michael Thurman to run, which we know that if an African-American—
And he has run a Senate campaign
before.
I
mean, so look, we don't have a problem of candidates who really are willing to go against David Perdue. But here's the thing I want to say lastly in defense of David Perdue. David Perdue is a shrewd enough politician to do what he's attempting to do, which is Brian is encouraging him to do. He has a great team of people over there with him, very experienced people who are looking at these numbers. But I tell you that they have a problem, and it's Donald Trump. And if Donald Trump continues to go down this bad road where he is basically almost kind of like, you know, is witness tampering. I mean, we haven't talked about that, how this guy is basically witness tampering. Allegedly, him and Giuliani have threatened Cohen to the point where this man has got to postpone his February 7th testimony where he's going to go under oath and say that the president told him to lie about his Moscow-Russia deal during the campaign. And so David Perdue, if Donald Trump goes down, it's going to be very, very difficult for David Perdue to be reelected.
Very quickly, just as a way to wrap up, Super Bowl is coming. There are Pepsi signs everywhere in Atlanta, home of Coca-Cola. Lowe's has just announced a sponsorship deal just at the time that the Super Bowl is in the home of the Home Depot, and the Patriots are in town.
Boo.
Yeah. At least it's not the Saints, right? I mean, granted, I do feel bad because the Saints did get robbed, but just as well.
So you back up Mary Bottoms sort of coming out and saying.
I thought she was hilarious. I thought it was well done.
Predictions.
It won't come as any surprise to anyone to know that I am a Georgia Bulldog first and foremost.
And you've got a Georgia Bulldog on running back
for
the Rams,
Todd Gurley.
And a Georgia Bulldog running back for the Patriots, Sonny Michel.
Sonny Michel, who's awesome. And then, of course, David Andrews, the center, and Isaiah Wynn, also on the Pats. So, but I hate to do this, Sonny and David and Isaiah, but I'm all Gurley this weekend. I can't
Todd Gurley, the Rams running back.
And what we call a damn good dog. And I cannot stomach the thought of seeing Tom Brady and that Kraft guy hoist another Super Bowl trophy. I hope the Rams are down 28-3 and then come back to win on the last play of the game.
Still too soon, Brian, to talk about 28-3.
I know. It hurts so much, Darren.
No, I'm definitely pulling for the Rams. I think New England, while I personally don't like Tom Brady for a lot of different reasons, I do respect his ability to win. And they are still there. I think this is now their, fourth straight.
It's their ninth AFC title.
Ninth AFC title. They've been to the Super Bowl three
Belichick.
Times in a row. And so, no, we definitely – but I want to say this also. I think that Atlanta is prepared. I know that this mayor, that MARTA, Jeff Parker, the CEO and general manager, are taking an enormous amount of precaution area.
They had that train derailment near the airport station right before loads of people arrive at the airport.
Well, thank God no one was hurt. And definitely some folks were delayed. And then also, you know, I want to look at you know, why we got to really end this government shutdown, because we need those TSA workers. We need those customs officers to be able to handle the, I think, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that we're going to get that are coming to this city. So go Rams, and definitely not rooting for the Pats.
But will they win?
I think the Rams are going to win. I think Philly showed us a roadmap. I think they showed the Falcons what they should have done. That is, when you have them down, put your foot on their neck, stay aggressive. You know, come up with trick plays. Don't let up, because they're an older team. They're smart. But if you let them hang around, they'll beat you. But I think they're going to get out early on them. They're going to keep the lead, and I think they'll win.
I think the Pats are going to win, because that's just how my life goes.
Well, as a longtime Falcons fan who suffered through that 28-3, and yet as someone with a family, the rest of the family is in New England, and a rabid Patriots fans, I'm just going to defer on this one. You can do that.
Very smart.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, communications consultant, and former national Southern regional director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Thanks to you both.
Go Rams.
Thank you, Dennis.
And if you like this show, subscribe. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That, of course, is a great way to make sure other people can find us. We will be back in your feed soon, and in your head, too, with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary. But when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.